Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintos.
This is the Donalana Kitchen. We gather around a kitchen table here at KHOY Community Radio and talk about food, farming, advice, recipes and opinions.
And the weather, even occasionally.
We do, because there's always something to talk about here in Iowa. This is community radio. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Yes, support for the Donalana Kitchen comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames, community-owned, community-focused, since 1974, open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
Donna, do you have any thoughts on eggplants?
Well, they're gorgeous, I have to say. They really are beautiful. The black, shiny ones that everyone knows, and then there's the white opalescent ones, and then there's the white ones with the purple streaks, and then they come in shapes and sizes and colors, and we are in the middle of eggplant season right
now. How do you know when they're ripe? Of course, if they're picked, they're usually by someone who knows it.
I mean, oh, you don't grow eggplant?
Not very successfully.
Well, they start to soften up a little bit, and mm-hmm. they get kind of less green. When they're really, really hard, they're not quite ready. It's kind of that simple.
Gotcha. What's some good things to do with an eggplant this time of year?
Easiest thing is to turn on the oven at medium, take a sheet pan, like a cookie tray or something, and cut the eggplant in half and cut off the little sticky bit on the end where the stem is, and put a little olive oil in it. Now, eggplant will sop up olive oil. So, you know, if you don't want it really soggy, I actually use my spray olive oil can for that. I spray the cookie sheet, then I put them cut side up, spray the cut side. Now, people go through this whole rigmarole about salting the eggplant
to get the bitterness
out. Maybe I'm just lazy, but I hardly ever do it.
I've never experienced an eggplant as bitter.
No. I don't know.
They must hang out in the wrong eggplant neighborhoods.
I guess so. So I just spray them up, put on a little, I do put salt and pepper for flavoring, and then I maybe crush a little dried basil or a little oregano or something, you know, something like that. You just stick them in the oven and you roast them until when you poke them with a fork, they're nice and soft. It's so simple. Then you can do anything you want with them. Either you can scrape them out and make what people call eggplant caviar, which is where you just kind of take the softened flesh and you mush it up. Or you can, I mean, if you're using fresh eggplant and they're not all leathery or all hard, I don't find the skin objectionable at all either. So you can eat the skin or not. It's kind of like potatoes. It's optional.
Yes. Get out there and enjoy those eggplants.
Those eggplants are really easy to cook.
Yum. So today on the Donalana Kitchen, we're going to be talking about the graduate program in sustainable agriculture and maybe a bit about tomatoes and the end of the season. Yes, we have a special guest in our studio
today. We do. I mean, I was realizing, you know, of course, we all are very aware that ISU is a big part of this community and everybody pays attention to the football and the this and the that. But something that we have here that's very, very special is the graduate program in sustainable agriculture. So we have a grad student today here, David Weisberger, who's going to tell us a little about the program. It is, I think, unique in the country in many ways, and we're very fortunate to have it here. So, David, welcome to the Donalana Kitchen.
Thanks for having me today.
Okay, so David has come here all the way from New York City. That's how attractive our program is. Tell us how you found out about it, David.
So it was somewhat of a roundabout journey for me here out to Iowa. I was working in farms back on the East Coast in the Hudson Valley of New York, and I didn't have an ag background at all, much like actually many of my peers in the program here.
So where did you do your undergraduate work?
So I studied actually philosophy at SUNY Stony Brook, which is a college out in Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to ag a little bit later. Again, kind of being a little bit tired with living in a city and wanting to explore different things.
Did you read Wendell Berry or something in philosophy?
You know, actually, my brother is an ethnobotanist by training. And he kind of roped me back into the natural world after being a
And the heady space is there?
Yeah. So I got back into it, and I knew that I wanted to kind of get more into the science, and I was interested in the mechanisms of how organic systems worked. And I applied to a couple different schools, and I spoke with Mary Wiedenhoft, who's my advisor now. She was the director of the program at that point. And I was actually going to work with a different professor in horticultural crops. And that professor at the time did not have funding.
Here at
Iowa
State.
And he didn't have funding at the time, and Mary did have funding
for
a small grains project.
Yes, Mary has a very interesting project.
Yeah, so I came in on this grant, which is exploring constraints to the viability of organic small grains here in Iowa. And, I got roped in because basically the goal was to keep working in organic systems and also to have an impact on the landscape. And when you get to work with field crops, they have a much greater surface area in Iowa, and that helps, I guess, helps me think about, okay, if we can make a small change in these field crops, we can have a large change in the landscape.
So here's the situation. Basically, I used to be the president of the Iowa Organic Association, and I was very, very interested in this issue, and Margaret Smith and Amber Anderson helped get this grant to bring David in. So the problem is an organic farmer can't just do corn, soy. They have to have at least a three-year rotation in order to build up the soil for their organic crops, because they're not using the same kind of, you know, NKP, nitrogen, all of those kinds of things. So an organic farmer in Iowa gets kind of stuck on that third rotation. I know some of them in the northern part of the state grow barley. Earl Hafner was really interested in this. He's doing different wheat, different beans. And Margaret Smith was always saying, I keep trying to do oats, but they won't come up to test weight. She was having, so it's difficult in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is because we've lost the kind of research that we need to grow these things. And the other part of it is we've lost the infrastructure.
Yeah, so when I first started digging into this, and I work now primarily with oats, I found out that there was a really famous a breeder and a plant pathologist at Iowa State named Ken Fry and J.R.D. Browning, respectively. And they worked for a long time on developing new oat cultivars and looking at pathogen resistance. And for a long time, that was a really major breeding program here in Iowa State, which was hard for me at the time to believe.
A long time. What time period are we talking about?
So both of them were actively publishing and contributing to literature and the field of plant breeding for a period of 40 years. So from the 60s up until the early 2000s when they both passed away. And they had plenty of grad students coming in and out of the program.
Yep, so it's dead and gone.
Yes, it is. Unfortunately passed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what were you able to take from what they'd left behind?
So they have a lot of really good information as to, okay, what works in Iowa. So one thing that I've been re-exploring is the effect of plant population. So in corn and beans, plant population is kind of a given field of study.
That means how many per acre?
Yeah, so
does that also have to do with, like, seeding quantities or spacing?
Mm-hmm.
Or
so, okay. You know, in Iowa, because corn and beans are so important to the economy and local farmers, it's down to an exact science.
Mm-hmm,
so we know
mm-hmm.
now that most soybeans are planted between 150 and 200,000 plants per acre, mm-hmm. right? And corn is usually planted somewhere around the 35,000 plants per acre number. So what J. Edgar Browning and what Ken Fry were doing is they were taking that same idea. They were looking at how many oat plants per acre would be most economically optimal. Right? And so that information was studied, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And we're just
including
varietal trials. And we're just trying to revisit some of that same information and look at, okay, what's economically optimal for an oat seeding rate?
And where are you doing these plantings?
So we have a couple different sites going on and a different, I guess, scopes of inference. So we have one smaller trial, which is just at the Iowa State University Ag Engineering and Agronomy Farm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just north of Matt Liebman's Marsden Research Plots mm-hmm. on certified mm-hmm. organic land. And we look at the effects of planting date and planting rate, which we think of as a population.
Mm-hmm.
And then in addition to that, we have a series of 7 on-farm trials that we've coordinated, and farmers have helped us undertake those on different sites around the state.
And this is not Practical Farmers of Iowa.
So we have had a nice series of, I guess, dovetail events with PFI, where we've been able to share some of our research, and we've been able to tap into their pool of growers who are, you know, as if you're familiar with BFI, these are a group of growers that are really interested in vetting scientific on-farm ideas, and they're really game to do it, and it's been a real pleasure to work with them.
So David, then, this is like the third year?
This is me coming into my third year, yeah.
Okay. So in this past summer, how many acres have you been able to play with, so to speak?
Ooh, that's somewhat of a tough question because the experimental sites are usually a little bit smaller. So our experimental site out at Marsden, for instance, is just a little over an acre. And the on-farm trials can vary based on the plot widths, which are going to vary based on the equipment that the farmers use. So they're usually somewhere between 4 and 10 acre experiments.
Okay, so you're getting enough oats in the ground to have some really viable data.
What we're trying to do is, you know, create a compelling story around oat management and small grain management at different sites around Iowa.
Okay, now, given the weather and the different kind of latitudes, or is it longitudes?
Latitudes,
okay. Is this going to apply all over the state? Or the south is a little different from the north,
we're trying to be, you know, good, rational scientists and agronomists when we do this and not go overboard with our scope of inference and say that, okay, this is going to apply in a certain situation. So right now I've done sites in central Iowa, and I'd be hesitant to kind of go beyond that scope of inference and say this is going to be applicable everywhere. But we're seeing some decent trends, and we want to be able to share that, and we think those are pretty much applicable across the state.
Do you think going north with this is more reasonable, like up into southern Minnesota? I mean, is this going to be, what's your feeling at this point for the
state of
oats
in Iowa? I think that you have a biophysical advantage as you go north in the state and into Minnesota, which is that things remain cooler later into the summer. So oats are a C3 crop, and they do not do very well in hot conditions.
Oh.
So the reason that, you know, large millers prefer oats out of Canada and the Dakotas and
and that's where you
Minnesota,
get the higher test weights.
That's where you get the higher test weights. It's because they have usually cooler nights, and those cooler nights are really important to the way those oat plants function and accumulate carbon.
So you're working with different breeds as well, right?
So we work with a couple different varieties, and in central Iowa here we work with a variety called Shelby 427, which is out of South Dakota State University. It was a fairly popular variety here. I don't think we'd continue to work with that variety because it's not done super well for us.
So you've eliminated one then, basically.
I think so. You know, just like any variety, usually resistance to pests, like let's say oat rust, which is a really serious fungal problem here in central Iowa and lots of parts, that resistance in the different varieties tends to break down after 5 and 10 years. So you want to be constantly thinking about, okay, I need to try a new variety, something that's been released in the last, you know, 2 to 3 years instead of
going
back.
So who's got an oat breeding program then?
So I think there's some positives to this. A graduate of Iowa State, Lucia Gutierrez, I hope I'm not butchering her name, she studied oat breeding here, and now she's faculty at Wisconsin. So they have a new small grains breeder, so that's
great.
Really good.
Great.
There's a small grains breeder at Illinois named Fred Kolb, who came out to last year's PFI conference. South Dakota has a new breeder who's originally from France, and she's very helpful, and she's going to be a long-term person in that position. And I believe Minnesota is actually going to have a new breeder pretty soon as well. And they've got some wheat and barley in addition to that. So we can kind of tap into resources in other Corn Belt states to help us with our small grains needs.
So then the other problem, of course, for small grains in Iowa has been we've lost our infrastructure, you know, our cleaning processes, our buying processes. I know that one of the partners in this project has been grain millers, which is in St. Ansgar. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on in terms of being able to market these products?
Sure. So grain millers has been very helpful during the duration of this project. And what they're really looking for is a food-grade product, which means oats that have a test weight, so a given weight in a given volume. So a bushel of oats to be milled needs to have a minimum of 36-pound weight. And for them, that's just a milling efficiency that they need to be able to hit at their facilities.
So, well, and also that means the the crop is more valuable to the farmer, too.
Absolutely.
For food grade,
yeah.
you always get a higher price. Mm-hmm. So
that's what I'll go
it would
into.
Be
yeah.
the goal of the farmer, right?
Mm-hmm. So that's your upper echelon. That's your peak goal.
Mm-hmm.
And over the last 2 years, a bushel of organic oats for the appropriate test weight has ranged between $6 and $7. So at that price point, for an organic system, it can actually be quite profitable.
Okay, so let me ask you then, and you know, you may not have quantified all this, but in your experience, has the test weight improved?
So test weight is usually really dependent on planting date and the environmental conditions in a given growing season.
That means the weather, right?
Exactly. So the big factor, the big deciding factor, is the one that we have the least amount of control
mm-hmm.
over. So the one thing we do know more and more about, and that we've known about for a while, is that an early planting date really facilitates the opportunity to get a higher test weight.
Okay, so we've had really early springs.
Yes, so the last 2 years have been fantastic from a certain perspective to study oats. Because we've had the opportunity to plant really, really early.
Mm-hmm.
Earl, for instance, I spoke with this past season, was was planting in mid-March this year.
Oh, wow.
And he really reaped the benefits of those, of that early planting date by getting a really high
Earl
test weight.
Earl is a gambling man, I have to say. He's always trying new things. He's the kind of man my mother would say, has a frog in every pocket. I really, really admire Earl's
But
work.
I think what we're seeing now is, after testing these things for a couple of years and looking back in the literature, is that maybe it's not a gamble to plant so early in March, that maybe it's actually a really good decision.
Can they take a little frost?
Yes. So oats can do pretty well down to really, really cold temperatures, and they'll germinate at a much lower temperature than corn and beans. So oats germinate more like 40 degrees Fahrenheit than 50 degrees Fahrenheit.
And then when do you harvest oats? How long do they grow?
So
March to...
Yeah, so usually if you're planting in early March, even if you're planting them to mid-April, you're going to end up harvesting some point between mid-July and early August.
Okay, so you're getting it in well before the corn and the soy, which
mm-hmm.
is, from a labor perspective, very...
Yeah, so, you know, small grains are great. You're able to spread your labor. It's kind of asynchronous to corn and soybean harvest and cultivation
mm-hmm.
times. You know, that's a really big benefit. The other thing that we found, this wasn't meant to be studied, but, you know, we started calibrating drills and going out and helping farmers calibrate drills and learning more about the equipment, is that when you're out there looking at your
drills
equipment...
Drills are a planting technique,
yeah, so
right?
I'm sorry. A drill is used... It's a planter for small
mm-hmm,
grains.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What you find is that when you start getting your equipment ready earlier, you look at, okay, maybe I need to change a spark plug on a tractor or something else needs to be changed. So I think it's a good tool just to get farmers out earlier, looking at their equipment, making sure everything is in order. So there's these multiple biological benefits to planting these other crops, these small grains crops. But there's also these kind of management benefits that I didn't think about until you start working with farmers and saying, hey, we can get a jump on something so we're not stressed out when corn and bean planting comes around.
Yeah, in other words, you're making the planting season more longer and
mm-hmm.
more room for doing things.
Yes.
You mentioned food grade oats.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when it's not food grade? People aren't the only things that eat oats. What happens to the other kind of grain?
Yes. So unfortunately, there are very, very poor markets for non-food grade products. So right now, non-food grade oat markets are almost non-existent, to be quite honest with you.
Which is a shame, because, of course, there's lots of uses for them in terms of animal feed.
Yes, there's lots of uses. I'm not an animal nutritionist.
Don't they feed it to racehorses or something, right?
Yes, so Earl Canfield is another PFI farmer, and he's been exploring the racehorse market up in northeast Iowa.
Oh, God, I thought... I meant that as a joke, but
no, it's not a joke at all. It's actually, you know, there is an industry here, and actually Nick Odie from PFI and I went down to help Earl at the horse show down in Des Moines this past year, and there's a real demand for that product. And again, it just goes
mm-hmm.
back to there are not too many places that will screen out the thins or the mids and be able to
tell us what the thins and the mids
exactly
are. All right,
so
come on.
If you sort them out, if you sort out a bushel of oats, you'll have a fraction of really heavy oats, theoretically speaking. You'll have some mid-sized oats and some thins, which are skinny.
Okay, this is still, you're going back to the test weight.
I am going back
how
to the test weight.
How big the grain actually is,
uh-huh.
right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, again, if there was more infrastructure to clean and separate seed, farmers might be able to pay a certain amount to get their grain separated. So you could, theoretically...
Do they do that with screens,
mm-hmm.
like in the milling process?
Exactly. This is a milling, a cleaning process.
And even for animal feed, do they have to take the coating off of it?
So it depends on the animal.
What's it called? The coating is called the what?
A hull.
A hull.
Yeah.
Oat hull. Okay.
Uh-huh. So hulled oats, right, without hulls, right, Those can be
what people eat.
This is what people eat. Those can be fed to hogs and chickens. And obviously something with a hull can be fed to any ruminant animal because they can digest that starch.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay.
So cool. There's a lot of opportunities there for moving small grains into other markets. Like you mentioned, it's really down to a lack of infrastructure at this point.
Right. We've mm-hmm. lost a lot of those things, even for cleaning it. And mm-hmm. do they use fanning mills on oats?
Absolutely.
Because Earl, out in one of his shed, had one of the oldest fanning mills I've ever seen. And I think that's what he uses, doesn't he?
I think Earl has a new facility now. I don't want to speak totally to it, but I think he's got some new equipment and he's working on kind of making their business as profitable and as large as possible.
We're talking to David Weisberger about oats. That's something that grows here in Iowa. Hope we can grow some more of it. You are listening to KHOI. This is Donalana Kitchen. Back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. What's on your plate? We'd like to hear from you. Contact us with comments, recipes, advice, opinions at khoiradio@gmail.com or you can call 515-292-2878 and leave a message for Donna or Lana. We're not here all the time, but somebody is. That email is khoiradio@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Today we are talking to David Weisberger about what he's studying and Iowa State and grains and things like that.
Yeah, and we want to know more about the graduate program in sustainable agriculture, better known as the GPSA.
I have to say, you said we were doing GPSA. I thought, we're going to do GPS? I don't want to talk about GPS.
No, GPS.
Okay. GPSA. Okay.
Graduate Program in Sustainable Agriculture, which is something that's going on big time here in Ames that most of us either we take for granted or else we don't know about it. So David is here getting his master's degree. He's been studying oat production on organic farms, something I think is quite fascinating, but, you know, it's for us food geeks here. Mm-hmm. But, David, tell us about how you learned about the program, what brought you here just to study sustainable ag. It is, I believe, the largest sustainable ag program in the country, isn't it?
I'm not sure about that right now, but it's the only place that offers a PhD in sustainable ag, and it was really one of the programs on the forefront of the sustainable ag movement in academia, in higher ed. I learned about it originally. I had been working at a not-for-profit farm in New York called Stone Barn Center, where Fred Kirschenman...
Oh, you came from Stone Barns.
Mm-hmm. I was working there for a small while. So I met Fred there.
Wait, what were you doing at Stone Barns?
Oh, I worked at more in fruit production, actually.
Yeah. Interesting.
So it's been a change. But I met Fred there, and I was kind of ruminating on whether or not school would be the good next step. And Fred obviously said, oh, you have to check out Iowa State. It's a great program. And a lot of things kind of came together, including my mom being from Iowa and my folks moving back to Iowa.
Really?
Yes, my mom's from Charles City, from Floyd County.
Oh, my. And they've moved back here?
I'm hoping that they're...
From the Bronx.
Yeah. So my dad's from the Bronx and my mom's from Iowa. I'm hoping that they'll move back here full time. Right now, they're kind of living half the year here and half the year back in New York.
Well, that doesn't sound terrible. Depends on which half of the year.
Yeah, exactly. So, again, that was a big factor.
Did she have, like, a family farm to come back to?
So it's a little bit more complicated. One of my great uncles, Harry, is from Soldier, Iowa in western Iowa. And they had the Century Farm in that town, and it kind of just got sold off in the 90s when the cousins moved to central Iowa.
Yes, same happened in my family.
Yeah, so that happened. So that's my kind of tenuous
So
Iowa
what would
farm
bring roots. Your parents back to Iowa then, other than the fact that you're here in school?
I think we're all pretty worn out from being in New York, and we all enjoy Iowa so much, so... Living here is not such a crazy proposition.
Well, don't tell everyone in New York, okay?
I won't, I promise.
We want to keep it this way,
yeah, exactly.
Okay? Just between us. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, so Fred was a big impetus to coming out. Fred Kirschenman. To checking this out. And like I said, I just got in touch with Mary, and she was really
Mary
great.
Mary Wiedenhoff?
Mary Wiedenhoff, I'm sorry. And I got in touch with Mary Wiedenhoff, and she said, well, I've got this project around small grains. We can fly you out to visit, and you can meet all the people involved with it. And I said, well, that's great. They seem to really want students out here, and they're supportive of it. And I came out, and I met some great people, and it just felt like the right thing to do.
Yeah. Now, let me say this, because my son went through the program as well, and are they called fellowships where you do research like this?
Yeah, assistantships or fellowships.
Yeah, but basically you end up with a degree and no college debt. So it really is a marvelous opportunity.
Yeah, I think that is a really good thing that they're continually able to find funding for students through grants and through Leopold
Center. Well, because you're doing very useful research that is applied to an industry that does make money.
Yeah, no, definitely.
So the GPSA is pretty well funded. For most of its students, right?
Yeah, I think most students receive a stipend plus at least half tuition, if not full tuition remittance. Again, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention just the basic history of the program, which Mary Wiedenhoff helped me find out a little bit about.
Mm-hmm.
It started in 2001.
So it's not that old.
It's not that old, but it's getting there.
And who started it?
So there's a group, there's a cohort of professors that wanted to address more complex issues in agriculture, and knew that an interdisciplinary approach was the best approach when looking at the complex issues in agriculture. And some of those that are still here are Mary Wiedenhoff and Matt Liebman and the Flores, who are still emeritus but around the campus. And some people have
That's
moved
Jan
on.
And Neil Flora. They're rural sociologists.
Mm-hmm. And then Ricardo Salvador, who's now with the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Yes.
And Michael Bell was in sociology, and he's now a professor at Wisconsin. So, again, there was a core group, and they decided this is the way we need to address issues in agriculture and the way we need to educate new scientists. And it was really important that they included a variety of disciplines. And for that reason, now the GPSA includes all 7 colleges at Iowa State. So
it's true. I know, like, for example, Adam Wright is in the writing and environmental program. So
absolutely.
He's getting his MFA, and then he's taking some GPSA courses so that he can do food writing, for example. My son, Arian Tubumri, was another example. He came in rural sociology. He got very interested in meat processing. He took a lot of GPSA courses and some meat science courses, as well as his rural. It's very across the disciplines. It's a mm-hmm. wonderful, wonderful program that
yeah,
way.
I think what's really encouraged is exploring a holistic vision of what your interests mm-hmm. are. So I'm interested, obviously, in oat production. But to really understand that, you have to understand a little bit about the history of Iowa and land use mm-hmm. change over mm-hmm. time and how policies affected that.
So what kind of courses have you taken besides the kind of agronomy things?
Yeah, so right now, for instance, I'm in a sociological methods class because a big part mm-hmm. of my degree is doing surveys with farmers and being able to understand and measure how their perceptions may be shaping agronomic practices.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I think that's a really good example mm-hmm. of what the GPSA allows a student to do.
Mm-hmm. What else about the program is unique? I mean, how many students are in the program?
So right now we have 40 students broken up between master's and PhD students, and there are 76 faculty members. And again, that's across lots of different disciplines. So agronomy, rural sociology, community and regional planning, economics, design, engineering. So it's a very, very diverse crowd.
Well, one thing, there are two things about the GPSA that I regularly, because I'm on the listserv just for fun, there's colloquium, which mm-hmm. you'll have to talk about,
yeah.
and then is it called the 501? What's that introductory?
Yes, so there are two really foundational courses that every GPSA student has to take. One of them is 610, which looks at the historical underpinnings of sustainable agriculture, especially as it relates to the Midwest, so reading about
Leopold. Who teaches that one?
That's Clark Wolf and Dr. Betty Wells.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So, okay, they're reading Aldo Leopold. What
mm-hmm.
else?
Wendell Berry and some, like, early sociologists, John Stuart Mill, mm-hmm. some basic economy stuff,
mm-hmm.
understanding
mm-hmm.
the basic context around why we are here.
What do you read from Wendell Berry?
Unsettling of America is the
okay.
big one.
Okay, I have to put a little plug for that book. Mm-hmm. It's already more than 25 years old. If anybody really wants to understand the issues about sustainable agriculture in this country, politically, sociologically, historically, do read Wendell Berry's
Unsettling of America.
Unsettling of America.
Can I make a cross plug that you're involved with, actually?
Yeah.
So in a few weeks,
oh, yes.
the Prairie Festival.
Yes, yes. Okay, that is at the Land Institute, which is in Salina, Kansas. Wendell will be, well, we say he'll be speaking, but usually Wendell just reads. And that is the last weekend in September, I think?
It's the 24th. So
the 24th, right. And I usually go and cook a big meal and some mm-hmm. kettles out yeah. on the prairie, and it's a good time was had by all. This is the 40th anniversary of the Land Institute. So Wes Jackson is a geneticist who mm-hmm. is breeding for perennial polyculture, which means he's from wheat country. But we now produce annual monoculture. That's corn and soy. We eat all of our crops. So his idea, which he's been working at a long time, is to breed perennial grains. Like he has actually perennialized wheat, something called Kernza, which we can eat if we go there. And it is being marketed. Some of it is being processed in St. Ansgar. And I think Minnesota is taking on crop improvement for Kernza. And there are other grains because Wes wants it to be a polyculture. So it is an independent, non-university, so they have to get all of their own funding and they do a lot of agricultural research.
So, and another kind of boon to the program is that the new director of the Land Institute is actually a grad of the GPSA, whose name is Fred Utzi.
That's right.
And he was in GPSA in agronomy. So he'll be taking over for Wes.
He will be. He will be. And we'll all get to meet Fred this coming Prairie Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And it is open to the public. If any of you want to drive out to Salina, look up on the Land Institute's website. We're expecting 1,200 people. This is kind of going to be a big deal. It
sounds like a big cooking kettle.
It's going to be a lot of food, I have to say.
So you mentioned another course in the GPSA, which is kind of foundational to how the program runs, which is 509.
Which is, everybody loves this course. I know that my son, he took it 1 year, and then he actually signed on so he could take it again the second year by being, I don't know, part of the staff or something mm-hmm. or other.
Yeah. So basically that's a, before school starts, there's
it's a big
really,
farm tour, isn't
it's
it?
It's a huge farm tour. It's a very immersive experience. It's an intense, fun, depending on when you took it.
So you just get in the vans and you go to specific farms to talk about
Yeah, so different professors have taught it over the years, and I think Dr. Betty Wells and Gretchen
Zarkowski
taught it for a long time together. And then when I took it, it was Matt Lehman, Gretchen, and Lisa Schulte-Moore, which mm-hmm. was a really a great group to
mm-hmm,
take it with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think
isn't Lisa a graduate of the program?
I am not sure about that, but
I think she's an ISU grad, I think.
I think Lisa studied at Michigan State.
I may be totally wrong about that. No, it could be
yeah.
Pete, her husband, who's okay. ISU.
Yeah. But I think right now it's Dr. Matt Liebman and Dr. John Tyndall, who's a natural resource economist.
And so give us an example of, like, the farms that you visited.
So when I took the class, we visited Bill Kauser's farm here in central Iowa. He runs an integrated crop livestock system. So he's a massive feedlot, and he does some corn production and some corn seed production and is involved in the ethanol industry. So that, for instance, was a really good example of kind of the integration of agriculture as it looked like in Iowa anyway. And I think the course overall is good for kind of blasting preconceptions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of us come in probably quite idealistic, and it gives a good, I guess, framing of what's going on here and why it's happening, and it puts a human face on what's happening.
Well, I was going to say, when the kids first started talking about the class itself, I'm thinking, yeah, sure, slam dunk. Of course, agriculture students should go and visit farms, but everybody gets so excited about it. So why is this, David?
I think you're in a van for a long period of time, and everyone's just, everyone's just kind of jazzed to be there because everyone has their own discipline, and
well,
they're excited.
Well, the fact is, people don't visit farms as much as they could.
No, and I think it's challenging, and I think in academia, participatory research or education is not the norm.
It's often in research fields, too.
Yeah.
Which are not the same as farms.
No.
Now, this could be why having Practical Farmers of Iowa headquartered in the same town as the Sustainable Ag Program could be advantageous, right?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of overlap, and there's been a lot of students in multiple departments who have contributed to PFI research reports and facilitating workshops and generally being involved with field days and all sorts of other activities.
And I have to say that to all the listeners, you don't have to be a member. You can attend field days. This is a wonderful resource for everybody,
yeah,
really.
My parents have attended to quite a few this
right.
past
They're
summer.
They're very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So what else, besides the feedlot corn grower farmer, what other kinds of things have you seen on those 501s?
Yeah, so we also visited Melissa and Andy Dunham in Grinnell. They have a really diverse...
Large vegetable organic
production. That was really interesting. I'm trying to think of who else. We also visit like some heavily industrialized operations.
Oh, we have all kinds of farming here in Iowa.
But we went to speak with some folks from DuPont Pioneer. I guess it's Dow DuPont now, who were running the cellulosic ethanol factory or plant over in Nevada.
Yep, right next door.
Yeah, so the kind
it's
of operations and the kind of people you visit, it really runs the gamut of what's going on mm-hmm. in the state.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that gives you good education, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
And you bring your broad education to everything you see. That's what's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that your undergraduate degree is in
philosophy.
That's a good place to start.
I suppose, yeah.
Oh, we didn't talk about. Tell us what colloquium is. That's really a lot of fun.
Yeah. So every Wednesday on campus, and I'm messing this up because I don't know the exact room, but it's in Curtis Hall in the Quaker Oats room, which is somewhat ironic. But there's a colloquium, and there's speakers invited from on campus and off campus, and from 3:10 to 5 p.m. It's a good chance to get exposed to lots of different ideas.
And that's actually a course, right?
For us, it's a course. It's open to anyone if you want to come check it out.
It's always interesting speakers. I sometimes go myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was involved in planning it last semester, and I helped plan one colloquium this fall, and if I can make a plug for that, I'd love to do that.
Oh, do. Tell us.
Yeah, so on October 12th, I believe that's a Wednesday night at 6:30 at the Ames Public Library, the Leopold Center was really kind to donate some funds to invite Dr. Rob Wallace, and he's a visiting scientist up at the University of Minnesota. And he talks about the transmittance and the transfer and the evolution of different animal-borne diseases.
Oh, and why is this going to be at the library? Because?
Because I wanted to hopefully engage a broader audience and get a broader crowd. And,
so is he going to talk about, like, MRSA and stuff like that?
He's going to talk about different HN configurations and the swine flus and avian flus. And since this was kind of ground zero for all of that last year.
Boy, do we need to... We don't have to worry, I don't think, about Zika right here, but we have our own issues to deal with. And so tell us the date and time again.
So it's October 12th, Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. at the Ames Public Library.
Okay. And David, do let us know closer to it. We will mention that again.
Absolutely.
October 12th at the library. Okay.
You are listening to KHOI. This is the Donalana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. So, the garden is winding down, canning, freezing, drying, and eating lots of things.
Oh, no, it's too soon. It's too soon.
Well, yes. All of this good stuff we get to eat and enjoy, the harvest season is going to sneak up on us. It's already starting.
Actually, some leaves are falling.
Oh, it is. It is. It is.
I know.
So, it's time to think about the next year's garden, too. You kind of watch things die, and you think, I can do that better next year. And you kind of put some cover crop there and dig this in there and plan for next year as you're tearing out the old. But there's still lots of things to enjoy. Donna, do you have any wisdom about fried green tomatoes? That is something that I've never had a taste for. I don't care for them at all. What about you?
Well, you know, they're kind of sour and lemony. I mean, that's the point. And They're what happens when the frost comes, you know? It's a fact of life. So it's kind of a sad thing. You look and there's all this big fruit hanging there and it's still green and what are you going to do? So you make fried green tomatoes.
There you go. The frost is a way off yet, but occasionally.
I mean, if you bread and fry almost anything, it's good.
All right. Give it a try.
But I don't know why you couldn't cook them in some kind of salsa kind of thing.
You should mention this.
I mean, cooking them probably helps. And if you throw some onions and garlic and a little hot sauce on, how bad could it be? I don't know. We'll have an experiment, Lonnie. You harvest those green tomatoes when the time comes, and we'll try some things.
I just happen to have a recipe here from my cousin Dave in Wisconsin.
Okay, Dave probably knows what to
do. He has a green tomato and jalapeno relish that he makes.
And he gave
me this recipe. And considering my cousin Dave is a big guy, he does everything in a big way. It starts out with half a gallon of green tomatoes, okay?
Well, you may be able to gather that for us.
Right. But I've made this recipe, but I have reduced
scaled
the,
it down.
Scaled it down. But so you got green tomatoes, onions, jalapeno peppers, and I put in some other varieties of pepper.
Oh, okay.
Too.
Good guess, Donna, huh?
Sugar, apple cider vinegar, cook it down, water, salt, and
So you can it.
Yeah. And then you can it. And
I bet
you could
freeze it if you were lazy like me. But,
well, I can it. It's good. I can't say it's the prettiest thing in the world, green tomatoes.
What do they turn kind of gray?
Brownish. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's this stuff. But
maybe if you put just a few little red bell peppers flex in it, you get some
that
color.
That works really, really well.
Or
yes, it does.
Or some nice yellow corn kernels.
That'd be good, too.
Okay.
What I have found, this is my favorite go-to thing to pull off the shelf and add to potato salad.
What a good idea.
That taste is just perfect. So thanks to Cousin Dave, I'll put this on the website. And you don't really have to make gallons of this at a time. You really can make
No, it depends on how many tomatoes
but,
you have.
But it's a for that, I, that is the one thing that I've found that
Speaking
it's good
Speaking of
for
potato salad, I forgot to tell you. Mm. You know, when we made pickled eggs?
Mm.
The pink pickled eggs, I had them sitting in the refrigerator, and I got tired of eating them. So yesterday, I made a potato salad, and I put chopped pickled eggs in it.
Now, see, that's another good thing to put in
it
a potato
good.
Salad.
It was good. It worked.
I wasn't able to
use the pickled beets that had been sitting in the vinegar for at least a month.
There you go.
It worked.
Just wing it. When you have something... Wing it. And
well, I'm
enjoy.
Sure that's how yeah. fried green tomatoes got going. They winged it. Of course, it's a southern specialty where they were used to frying everything like that. Fried okra, fried chicken.
Yeah.
Why not fry the green tomatoes?
I like it. That's good. Also, thinking about the garden for next year, this is the time of year that I start eyeing up my tomatoes. Which ones did good? I like to save seeds. And there's four steps for saving seeds of tomatoes.
Oh, yeah, this is more complicated than I thought. I just thought you just spread the seeds out on the paper towels and that's it. So what do you do?
Well, tomatoes, as you know, tomatoes have this gushy, wonderful stuff that surrounds all the seeds on the inside. And that protects the seeds and it keeps them from germinating inside the tomato. And you want to get rid
is
of
it
that.
Mucilaginic?
It's mucilaginic. It's glop. Yes, it is. So, basically, I do. There's four things you do. You squish out the seeds of the tomatoes.
How do you squish them? Oh, you mean you? How do you squish them out of the tomatoes?
Now, if you don't want them to hit you in the eye. When you squish the tomato, I cut an X on the bottom of the tomato, on the bottom end of the tomato, and then squish, because then all the stuff goes
you
down.
You squeeze it, you mean?
Squeeze it.
But you don't, can you still
just
eat the tomato
yes,
after
you
that?
Can.
Okay,
yes,
so
you
don't squeeze it too hard.
If you want to use it for salsa, you can, or whatever, use it. That's fine. You get out the seeds. Then, be sure to label this, folks. When you use your open pollinated seed.
What do you squish them onto?
I squish them into little Tupperware containers.
Okay.
And then it has to ferment on the counter for 3 to 5 days to get rid of.
It just sits there
it just
at room temperature.
At room temperature. And a white mold happens on the top of it.
White.
And you think, oh.
If it's not white, then what happens?
I don't know. I've never had anything but white. All is not lost. It's supposed to happen. That's supposed to happen. That breaks down that gelatinous stuff. After 3 to 5 days when there's white mold, you scrape that off. And if there's any seeds floating on the top, because it's really watery at this time, you take those off, too, because the floaty seeds aren't as good as the one that sinks to the bottom.
Non-viable seeds, okay.
You rinse with warm water, hot water, warm water. Put it in a sieve. Then
right,
you turn
you
that,
don't want to kill the
no,
seeds.
No.
They're
then,
alive.
Then after you get rid of the gush, you turn it over on a saucer and dry on the kitchen counter for a couple of days until it's completely
kinda
dry.
Kind of have to spread them out,
kind of
right?
have to spread
right.
them out.
Okay, because otherwise
then,
they're going to ferment again.
Right, and then you store them. Dark and dry, and be sure to label them. And this only works with open pollinated seeds, not hybrid seeds.
And how do you know? From reading your seed pack, you know which ones are open pollinated?
Yes.
It's the only way to know. So you have to save your seed packs, too, then.
Well, or just kind of learn as you go. I have a lot of tomato references.
Are you going to tell me that you remember these things?
Well, some people can remember, like, you know, when their grandchildren's birthday are. You know, I can remember things.
I can remember that because I only have one grandchild. But, you know, you grew 30 varieties of tomatoes this year.
I don't save the seeds from all of them. No, just a few.
Just your favorites?
Just my favorites.
Okay, okay.
Just my favorites. So, you can look up on the internet about saving seeds, and I learned how to do it from the Seed Savers Exchange in Decorah. They have a little online tutorial if you'd
like. You know,
like
something else I learned from Seed Savers, that the main farmer man, whose name I cannot remember, but he's an authority on these things, I said to him right after I had moved here from California, and so it was heirloom tomatoes, heirloom tomatoes. Everyone's growing heirloom tomatoes. And so I'm looking around. And, of course, in California, we have been growing a lot of heirloom tomatoes. And I was quite familiar with, you know, the zebras and the purple Cherokees and the ones that everybody loves out there. Well, we were growing the same varieties here, only somehow they didn't taste as good as the California tomatoes. And I'm kind of, and I knew that because my palate was still fresh from eating both kinds. So I said this to the Seed Saver guy. I said, what's up with this? And he said, well, the best tomatoes to grow in Iowa are those that have come to us from Russia, because we have a colder climate here, and those varieties will have the deepest flavor here. So when you're picking your tomato seeds, especially if you're looking at the Seed Savers catalog, and they kind of indicate where it comes from, try out some of those old Russian varieties and see what happens here in Iowa. We have the right climate for growing the Russian varieties of tomatoes.
Yes, do that. Taste. Every tomato is different, so develop your own palate and try saving the seeds sometime. It does
what
work.
What are you going to save this year, Alana?
I always save something called a garden peach, which actually I think was a really strange cross in my garden, because I crossed the Wapsipinicon peach with something or other in my garden, and I got a really nice, much bigger, fuzzy, late-season tomato. So I just keep that one.
So Lana's doing her own specialty tomato breeding here at Onion Creek Farm.
Catching by can. And then there's a lot of pink ones, the roses, Ava's purple ball, and some of the Anna Russian. Those I do keep because they're just fun. They taste good. I like those. Mm-hmm. And I like something called a black plum. I always save that one. It's just, and it what works on your farm is what's good for you. What works in your tomato section of your garden works for you. Yes, it does.
She speaks from experience.
Well, I'm just kind of a tomato geek. That's fine. So we've been talking a little bit about tomatoes. Try to make a green tomato and jalapeno relish.
But it's not quite time yet, though. Don't do it yet.
Oh, no. But when it comes and there's
be prepared
tomatoes,
for when the frost is coming.
Be prepared. We've got a ways to go. But I'm already kind of looking at those. I plan ahead. I plan ahead this time of year. Yes. And so think of that. And think of potato salad. Oh, potato salad with pickled eggs in it sounds really good.
It worked really well.
There you go. We've been talking to David Weisberger about the GPSA, which is
Graduate Program in Sustainable Agriculture at ISU, a really, really unique program. We're so lucky to have all of those students here. I have enjoyed socializing with many of them for a long time. David and I have had great ice cream conversations. Did you make some ice cream, David?
Not yet, so I'm waiting for pawpaws.
Oh, the pawpaw. We're going to have pawpaw ice cream.
That sounds
absolutely
good.
Okay,
yeah,
goody, goody, goody.
Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Good. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Thanks to David for joining us today. You can find out more about Donna Lana Kitchen and this fine radio station by going to khoifm.org. You can stream, you can podcast, you can go to the Donna Lana Kitchen archives, look up some recipes. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Excellent engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.